From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It was a busy first weekend for the new President Donald Trump and his new press secretary, Sean Spicer. Spicer faced questions from the press for the first time Monday, and we bring you excerpts from that press conference.
Let me begin by saying that the president has been closely monitoring the severe weather in the southeast. He spoke by phone with Governor Deal of Georgia yesterday and offered his condolences and support. Today, President Trump is focused on fulfilling his pledge to pursue trade policies that put America first. The president began his day with a breakfast with key U.S. business leaders, where the focus of the discussion was on job creation and growing our manufacturing base. Business leaders who attended included Michael Dell, the founder and CEO of Dell, Jeff Fettig, the CEO of Whirlpool, Mark Fields, the CEO of Ford, Alex Gorsky, the CEO of Johnson & Johnson, Marilyn Hewson, the CEO of Lockheed Martin, Klaus Kleinfeld, the CEO of Arconic, Andrew Liveris, the CEO of Dow, Mario Longhi, the CEO of U.S. Steel, Elon Musk of SpaceX and Tesla, Kevin Plank of Under Armour, Mark Sutton of International Paper, Wendell Weeks, the CEO of Corning, Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, the Vice President's Chief of Staff Josh Pitcock, and Senior Advisor Stephen Miller. The breakfast was an opportunity for the president to hear directly from America's top business leaders about the challenges they're facing and take some suggestions about what policies and action can be taken to help them create jobs and grow our manufacturing base. The meeting included a really great exchange of ideas, and the president has decided to reconvene the group in a month and then have them meet on a quarterly basis. As you know, the president's vision is to negotiate fair trade deals that create jobs, increase American wages, and reduce Americans' trade deficit. He's appointed a tough and smart number of trade experts who will fight on behalf of American workers. With that vision in mind, the president has already taken several steps today. First, he issued a presidential memorandum withdrawing the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. TPP is a multilateral agreement that includes the United States and 11 other countries. As the president has said many times, this type of multinational agreement is not in our best interest, and he's moving quickly to advance trade policies that increase the competitiveness of the American worker and manufacturer. This executive action ushers in a new era of U.S. trade policy in which the Trump administration will pursue bilateral trade opportunities with allies around the globe. This is a strong signal that the Trump administration wants free and fair trade throughout the world. Additionally, the president issued a memorandum reestablishing the Mexico City policy, stating that the United States will end the use of taxpayer dollars to fund abortions overseas, along with coercive abortion and sterilization practices. Finally, the president issued a memorandum outlining executive branch hiring. This memorandum counters the dramatic expansion of the federal workforce in recent years. In particular, it prevents filling vacant positions and creating new positions except when necessary to meet national or public security responsibilities. It does not apply to military personnel, and it ensures that the American taxpayers get effective and efficient government. Earlier in the day, the president spoke with Egyptian President el-Sisi. They discussed ways to deepen the bilateral relationship and support Egypt's fight against terrorists and bolster Egypt's homegrown and historic economic reform program. President Trump underscored the United States remains strongly committed to the bilateral relationship, which has helped both countries overcome challenges in the region for decades. The president committed to continuing military assistance to Egypt and working with Egypt to ensure that assistance most effectively supports the Egyptian military's fight against terrorism. The president also commended President el-Sisi for his courageous steps to address Egypt's economic challenges and offered to discuss ways the United States could support Egypt's economic reform program. Finally, the two leaders discussed a visit to the United States in the future. The president then had lunch with the vice president, where they recapped this morning's meetings and discussed next steps. They also had discussed plans to advance the president's legislative agenda to make America safer and more prosperous. Also today, the president signed designations for acting heads of executive departments and agencies to maintain continuity in those critical positions. At 3 o'clock, union leaders and frontline workers will meet with the president to discuss his pro-worker agenda. Attendees include Tom Flynn of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, Sean McGarvey, president of the North American Building and Construction Trades Department, Terry O'Sullivan, general president of the Laborers International Union of America, Gary Massino, the Sheet Metal Workers Union Smart Union. The president has been honored to receive tremendous support from union working men and women on Election Day, and he's dedicated to growing and deepening their support. And he made it a priority to meet with these union workers on our working day one here in the White House. The offshoring of American jobs and lack of economic growth in recent years has hit American workers particularly hard. And the president's top priority is to retain and attract American jobs, which have already seen happening through his actions on Carrier, Sprint, General Motors, and so many more. At 5 o'clock, the president will host a bicameral bipartisan meeting with leaders here at the White House that will include the vice president, the Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Majority Whip, the Senate Minority Leader, the Senate Minority Whip, the House Speaker, the House Majority Leader, the House Democratic Leader, the House Democratic Whip, the White House Chief of Staff, our Chief Strategist, Chief of Staff to the Vice President, and Chiefs of Staff from those respective offices. The purpose of the meeting is to get the President's agenda moving through Congress. The American people are frustrated with the lack of progress here in Washington, and the President wants no delay in addressing our most pressing issues. He's taking every step opportunity to forge strong bonds with congressional leaders on both sides of the aisle. Rounding out today's schedule, after the reception that I mentioned, he will have dinner with, or he have a meeting with the House Speaker, Paul Ryan. They will discuss the Republican legislative agenda and strategy going forward. As you know, we are all about big viewerships and large audiences here. So I want to tell you about an effort that we're undertaking here in the press briefing room to offer up more access to a group of journalists from around the country. Beginning later this week, I'm excited to announce that we're going to have four what we call Skype seats live here in the briefing room. This will open up the briefing to journalists who live beyond 50 miles of the Washington, D.C. area and to organizations that don't currently have a hard pass. As always, any organization is welcome to apply for a day pass. But we're excited to open up into the field and fold here a diverse group of journalists from around the country who may not have the convenience or funding to travel to Washington. I think this can benefit us all by giving a platform to voices that are not necessarily based here in the Beltway. Looking ahead, the president will have a breakfast tomorrow with the auto industry, including heads of GM, Chrysler, and Ford. He looks forward to hearing their ideas on how we can work together to bring more jobs back to this industry in particular. On Wednesday, the president will host a swearing-in ceremony from new Secretary of Homeland Security, General James Kelly, John Kelly. And then on Friday, he will do the same for Secretary Mattis at the Department of Defense. On Thursday, he will travel to Philadelphia to attend the Republican House and Senate retreat. And on Friday, he will welcome his first foreign head of state, British Prime Minister May. With that, I look forward to taking your questions. Daniel Halper, New York Post.
Hey, John, thank you. When will you guys commence the building of the border wall?
When will what?
When will you start building of the border wall?
I think the president has noted that this was a serious priority of his throughout the campaign. He has already started to work with Congress on the appropriations avenue of that. And so he is doing everything he can to direct agencies and Congress to commence with that work as soon as possible.
And what about with Obamacare? Are you guys enforcing the mandate or not?
Enforcing the mandate?
Yes. The Obamacare mandate, Kellyanne.
I think, look, the president has made it clear that he's going to work with Congress to, and part of the discussion that he's going to have tonight with some of these leaders, and then again with Paul Ryan, is how we can work to implement both the repeal and replace aspects of this. Jennifer Wishon.
Of all the policy or actions that the president could have taken today, he chose to reinstate the Mexico City policy. What message is he sending here? Does he see the elimination, reduction of abortions as an American value? And also, here at home, can pro-life Americans expect him to put his signature on legislation that will defund Planned Parenthood?
Well, I think the president, it's no secret, has made it very clear that he's a pro-life president. He wants to stand up for all Americans, including the unborn. And I think the reinstatement of this policy is not just something that echoes that value, but respects taxpayer funding as well and ensures that we're standing up not just for life of the unborn, but for also taxpayer funds that are being spent overseas to perform an action that is contrary to the values of this president. And I think continue to further illustrate not just to the folks here in this country, but around the world of what a value we place on life. Jennifer Rodriguez.
Janet,
I'm sorry.
Thank you. What did Mr. Griffiths mean when he said that he would work through Congress to get a special something, we don't know what it is, for DACA recipients? And when can we expect that to happen? And also, when can we expect the White House Spanish site to be back up?
Okay, two questions. Let me start with the latter first. As you know, we hit the ground running on day one. There was a lot to do, and we had done a lot of work on the website to make sure that we were prepared to get as much information up as fast as possible. We are continuing to build out the website, both in the area, the issue areas, and then that area. But we've got the IT folks working overtime right now to continue to get all of that up to speed. And trust me, it's just going to take a little bit more time, but we're working piece by piece to get that done. On the DACA piece, I think the president's been clear that he was going to prioritize the areas of dealing with the immigration system, both building the wall and making sure that we address people who are in this country illegally. First and foremost, the president's been very, very clear that we need to direct agencies to focus on those who are in this country illegally and have a record a criminal record or pose a threat to the American people. That's where the priority is going to be, and then we're going to continue to work through the entire number of folks that are here illegally. But right now, the clear focus is on that.
Sean?
Blake Furman, Fox Business.
Hey, Sean, I want to ask you two questions. Two questions, money-related. The president campaigned on the corporate tax cut rate of 15%, and today when he met with the business leaders, he had mentioned that the tax rate would drop to somewhere between 15 to 20%. Is he moving the goalpost there in any way? And my second question is on government spending. There have been reports that you might be looking at $10 trillion over the course of 10 years. Is that accurate, and would you be willing to wrap up entitlements to get there?
Well, I think first, I'll take the other one first, on entitlements or on spending. Look, I think you saw this with the hiring freeze. There's been, frankly, to some degree, a lack of respect for taxpayer dollars in this town for a long time. And I think what the president's showing through the hiring freeze, first and foremost today, is that we've got to respect the American taxpayer. They're sending us a ton of money. They're working real hard. Some people are working 2-3 jobs just to get by. And to see money get wasted in Washington on a job that is duplicative is insulting to the hard work that they do to pay their taxes. And I think that that comes into your question in overall spending as well. We've got to look at how we're spending the American people's tax money. And so what the work that the landing teams have been doing is going into these agencies and departments and talking about ways that we can create greater efficiencies, eliminate duplicity, and maximize the tax dollar. So it's more a question instead of just cutting. It's about how do we spend and respect the American taxpayer dollar more than anyone, more going forward. April Ryan.
On that 15 to 20%, sorry?
Oh, I'm sorry. Look, the president's a very successful businessman and negotiator. He's going to sit down and work with Congress to get the best deal possible for American businesses so that they can hire more people and we can expand and we can grow the economy. So he's going to work with Congress on that rate. But he understands better than anybody how to negotiate a great deal. And right now, he's going to negotiate the best deal on behalf of the American worker and on behalf of the American businesses that are hiring them. That was a lot of the focus that went on today, talking to these companies. And it was interesting. The meeting was only supposed to last an hour. It overflowed another hour in the Oval Office. And he kept asking them, what ideas do you have to grow this economy? What is preventing you from hiring people? What regulations are stopping you from conducting more business? What are the ways that we can give you more market access into, you know, other countries around the globe? And I think that's what his focus is going to continue to be, is how do we create a tax and regulatory environment that grows the economy and benefits the American worker? So it's not just about creating more jobs, but it's also about lifting up those jobs through higher wages. April Ryan.
Sean, I have a couple of questions, if you allow me to take them one at a time.
I will.
Elijah Cummings, Maryland congressman, Democratic Maryland congressman, confirmed that President Donald Trump talked to him at the luncheon about the high price of prescription drugs. When is this meeting and going to be set, or is it coming up soon? And will the president be meeting with the full body of the Congressional Black Caucus as well as the Hispanic Caucus on issues related to those communities?
Okay. Let's take one at a time. I'm not aware of the conversation. I'm sure you've heard the president the last couple of weeks talk about the price of pharmaceutical drugs and the need to get those prices down and bring manufacturing back in the pharmaceutical industry to benefit the country. So it's an issue that's he's going to continue to work on. He understands as we reform health care, as we repeal and replace Obamacare, the getting a hold of the cost of prescription drugs to give more people access to them, but also to allow greater access in healthcare, greater plans in healthcare. That's going to be a key part of it. So that's going to happen. I think, look, you're seeing with respect to the other meetings, it's day one, working day one here. He's going to start with the leadership. He's going to have a great conversation with them. But then I think you're going to see a variety of meetings, the Congressional Black Caucus, the Hispanic Caucus, small groups of meetings. He's someone who really enjoys that kind of conversation. I think you're going to see a lot of meetings occur, like the ones that you did today, the business leaders coming in, these union workers. And it's interesting. The president was asking these folks today, how many of you have been in the Oval Office? Three of them raised their hand. We talked to some of these union leaders, and we hear, we didn't get a lot of attention. And here we are on working day one, and you've got the president reaching out to some of America's best business leaders, and then some of the union workers and line workers, and bringing them in and saying, I want to listen to what's going on in your life. What can we be doing to help you? And I think that you're going to see a lot more of that, a listening president who's engaged in trying to figure out what policies and actions that he can take, that this government can take, that he can work with Congress to make people's lives better, to make their security better, to make their economic security better. But you're going to see a lot of that. That's who he is. That's what he did during the transition, and I think that's what he's going to do going forward. He appreciates the ideas and opinions that come through the Oval Office or in small groups where he gets to share their perspective or their ideas or their opinions. I think that's what he's going to continue to do later this afternoon.
I want to go back to what the gentleman said about the mandate, the New York Post gentleman. He said something about the Obamacare now in the mandate. With the numbers that you talked about and it's been in the news from the inauguration day and the numbers Saturday, do you believe that you have the mandate to be able to force through what you had talked about, replacing portions of Obamacare that really subsidize the whole piece of it to help low-income people get health care?
Well, I think what we have is a mandate to make health care more accessible and lower cost. That's what the American people were promised under Obamacare. And I think it's not a question about a mandate, and it's also not about forcing anything. It's about what's doing the right thing. It's about providing people what they've been promised, which is you go around this country and you look market after market, they're down to one plan. That's not what the American people were promised. Not only that, but in many cases, you're seeing the rates go up 10, 15, 20, 30, 50%. That's not what they were promised either. And so I think what the president's doing, and it's not just, I think he's gotten bipartisan support for this, to work with Congress and to take executive action where necessary to implement a health care system that provides more people health care, truly allows them to keep the doctor and plan that they're signing up for, lowers cost, creates more competition. So do I think he has a mandate? Sure. But it's not on this issue. I think that all leaders have a mandate from the American people to fix this system and make it better. Julie Pace.
Okay, John, I've got two foreign policy topics I want to get to. There's some discrepancy between what the Russians are saying and what the Pentagon is saying in terms of some potential joint action. Can you clarify that? And generally, is the president open to joint action in Syria with the Russians?
On that instance, I know it's still developing, and I would refer you back to the Department of Defense. I know that they're currently monitoring this, and I would refer you back to them on that. And I think the president has been very clear that he's going to work with any country that shares our interest in defeating ISIS, not just on the national security front, but on the economic front. If we can work with someone to create greater market access and spur economic growth and allow U.S. small businesses and companies to...
But just on this idea of doing joint military actions with Russia and Syria.
I think there's a way that we can combat ISIS with any country, whether it's Russia or anyone else, and we have a shared national interest in that, sure, we'll take it.
And then the second thing is when he was at the CIA on Saturday, he was talking about the U.S. not taking oil during the Iraq war, and he said that there could be another chance for that. What did he mean when he said that?
Well, I think what the president's been very clear about in foreign policy is too often the United States is going in with a lot of money, a lot of manpower, and in many cases losing both loss of life, and we want to make sure that our interests are protected. And so if we're going in to a country for a cause, I think he wants to make sure that America's getting something out of it for the commitment and the sacrifice that we're making.
Was he foreshadowing upcoming action?
I think he's been very clear from throughout the campaign that he is committed to making sure that America, the American people and the American taxpayer see some benefit and ensure that our interests overseas are not just sending blank checks, that we're doing something that either protects America or is in our economic interest.
John Roberts.
A couple of things, if I could. Later this week, in his executive actions, does the president plan to take action to greenlight the Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines? And on TPP, John McCain says it was a serious mistake to do what the president did for America's economy and for our strategic position in the Asia Pacific. Why was TPP the right thing to do? Why was it the right thing to do to repeal TPP?
Because I think the multinational, when you enter into these multinational agreements, you're allowing any country, no matter the size, any one of those 12, including us, to basically have the same stature as the United States in the agreement. So we're basically on par with some very small companies who are getting access to an amazing market, the United States, and in return, we're negotiating at the lowest common denominator. And I think that when you look at big multinational agreements, multilateral agreements, they're not always in the best interest of the United States. The beautiful thing about a bilateral agreement is that if any one of the two parties in the agreement decides at any time they want to get out of the agreement or they're not being treated fairly, they can renegotiate it much easier. In a multinational agreement, that's not the case. In many cases, all of the other countries have to agree to an action or to let somebody out. That's not putting the U.S. interest first.
And on the question about Keystone and Dakota Access,
I'm not going to get in front of the president's executive actions, but I will tell you that areas like Dakota and the Keystone Pipeline, areas that we can increase jobs, increase economic growth, and tap into America's energy supply more, that's something that he has been very clear about. I think he talked about it not only on the campaign, but around the Thanksgiving period. He was talking about that being a big priority. That's one of those ones where I think that the energy sector and our natural resources are an area where I think the president is very, very keen on making sure that we maximize our use of natural resources to America's benefit. It's good for economic growth, it's good for jobs, and it's good for American energy. Jonathan Carl.
Thank you for being here. First briefing, great to see you.
Thank you.
Before I get to a policy question, just a question about the nature of your job.
Yeah.
Is it your intention to always tell the truth from that podium, and will you pledge never to knowingly say something that is not factual?
It is. It's an honor to do this, and yes, I believe that we have to be honest with the American people. I think sometimes we can disagree with the facts. There are certain things that we may miss. We may not fully understand when we come out, but our intention is never to lie to you, Jonathan. Our job is to make sure that sometimes, and you're in the same boat. I mean, there are times when you guys tweet something out or write a story and you publish a correction. That doesn't mean that you were intentionally trying to deceive readers and the American people, does it? And I think we should be afforded the same opportunity. There are times when we believe something to be true or we get something from an agency or we act in haste because the information available wasn't complete, but our desire to communicate with the American people and make sure that you have the most complete story at the time. And so we do it. But again, I think that when you look net-net, we're going to do our best every time we can. I'm going to come out here and tell you the facts as I know them. And if we make a mistake, I'll do our best to correct it. But I think as I mentioned the other day, it is a two-way street. There are many mistakes that the media makes all the time. They misreport something, they don't report something, they get a fact wrong. I don't think that's always to turn around and say, okay, you were intentionally lying. I think we all go try to do our best job and do it with a degree of integrity that in our respective industries.
Do you have any corrections that you would like to make or clarifications of what you said on Saturday?
Sure. Well, ask away, Jonathan.
Well, just for instance, I don't want to get into relitigate the whole issue, but like, just take one, like the issue of metro ridership. You made a statement about.
We did, and at the time, the information that I was provided by the inaugural committee came from an outside agency that we reported on. And I think, knowing what we know now, we can tell that WMATA's numbers are different. But we were trying to provide numbers that we had been provided. That wasn't like we made them up out of thin air.
And do you stand by your statement that was the most watched inaugural address?
Sure. It was the most watched inaugural. When you look at, look, You look at just the one network alone got 16.9 million people online. Another couple of the networks, there were tens of million people that watched that online. Never mind the audience that was here, 31 million people watched it on television. Combine that with the tens of millions of people that watched it online on a device, it's unquestionable. I don't see any numbers that dispute that. When you add up attendance, viewership, or total audience in terms of tablets, phones, on television, I'd love to see any information that proves that otherwise.
And then one other...
Do you dispute that?
Well, I don't want to get into numbers.
I do. Okay. I mean, okay. I'm just saying, if you're asking me a question about my integrity, I have a right to say, if you add up the network streaming numbers, Facebook, YouTube, all of the various live streamings that we have information on so far, I don't think there's any question. It was the largest watched inauguration ever.
More than Ronald Reagan's in 1981.
I'm pretty sure that Reagan didn't have YouTube, Facebook, or the internet. I think 41 million people watched his. 41 million watched his, okay? So let's just take the Nielsen ratings, which are 31 million, and add it to CNN, 16.9 million. That's a little higher. So I'm just saying, you're asking me for numbers. There's just two entities together.
And the approach that you took on Saturday, any second thoughts on that?
Look, I think we're gonna, Jonathan, look. I want this to, huh? You know. I came out to read a statement, and I did it. We're here today. I'm going to stay here as long as you want. So I want to make sure that I think you guys might want to leave before I do. But look, I want to make sure that we have a healthy relationship. We saw the other day that, and I'm not trying to rehash history, but you're asking the question, so I'm going to answer it. You know, we had a tweet go out about Martin Luther King. Think about how racially charged that is. And someone rushes out and says to the entire press corps that the President of the United States has removed the bust from his office. Think about what the signal... Hold on, please.
And apologize.
No, no, he actually applies to, quote, my colleagues. That's the exact quote. Okay? That quote, that report got tweeted out around. And to report, where was the apology to the President of the United States? Where was the apology to millions of people who read that and thought how racially insensitive that was? Where was that apology?
You accepted his apology, though, Sean.
Okay, I'm asking, where was that apology? And so I'm just saying that when things like that happen, when John Lewis says that he's never missed an inauguration, and we find out, actually, he did, he skipped George W. Bush's, that there are points at which we have a right to make sure that we correct the record. I mean, you're talking about integrity, and you're talking about telling the truth and facts. I don't know that it wasn't malicious at all, and I'm not saying, but there's a point at which we have a right to go out there and correct the record. And I think that over and over again, there is this attempt to go after this president and say, well, that can't be true, and that's not right, and the numbers weren't there. And there's a rush to judgment every time. And it's a two-way street. We want to have a healthy and open dialogue with the press corps and with the American people about what he's doing to help this country and to unite it. But at a time when he's trying to unite this and he keeps talking about uniting this nation, bringing people together, and then a tweet goes out in a pool report to, what, a few thousand people saying that he removed the bust of Martin Luther King, how do you think that goes over?
Sean, did the media invent the feud between the president and the intelligence community?
I think that you saw from the response the other day, he walked into the CIA, people were hooting and hollering, they gave him a 5-minute standing ovation. That doesn't look like a relationship they were excited.
This is not a media invention.
I think there's a difference between having differences with intelligence leaders and leaders of that community who had strong differences with, than the people and the men and women who toil every single day in our intelligence community. And it was reflected at the CIA. I mean, they came there. They were so excited. There was 1,000 people that applied for 300-plus seats. We ended up taking in 400 people. That doesn't sound like a huge feud. They were excited. They were clapping. They were cheering when he walked in. And to see reports that made it sound like there was some, you know, fence mending that had need to happen, that sure didn't look that way when you walked in. I'm going to move on. Yeah.
Sean, can I ask, What is the U.S. strategic interest in moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem? And also, in the chat with President al-Sisi today, was the status of the Muslim Brotherhood discussed?
Well, I think the readout, I just gave you the readout on the call with President al-Sisi, and I think that speaks for itself, what was discussed. And then, I'm sorry, the first part?
What is the U.S. strategic interest in moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to
Jerusalem? As I noted yesterday through several press inquiries, there's no decisions. We're at the very early stages of that decision-making process.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.